going to go ahead and get started. I'm Terry Thornton. I'm Curator of Education, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. Tuesday Evenings, maybe I'll go down one more. Yeah? It's nice to have music and visuals. I told somebody I've had it my choice I'd do this from a closet, so this is good. Just pay attention to the screen. All right, glad to have you here tonight. Tuesday Evenings is, of course, a weekly lecture program. I think many of you are familiar with it. It's free and open to the public with, I have to say, this season it's a particularly exceptional lineup thanks to the extraordinary artists and other scholars who have agreed to participate. We run through November 19th this fall, so hope you can make it back. You can find the full schedule with descriptions of each lecture on the Modern's website. Tonight we are fortunate to have Andy Colquitt here from Austin, where he has lived, worked, and actively participated in the community for more than 20 years. In 1988, he received his BFA in art history from the University of Texas, leaving the next year for graduate studies at UCLA only to return and begin the graduate program at UT Austin in 1993. With a long-standing interest in creating place, Andy is perhaps most widely known for A House, which some of you may be familiar with. It is a performance studio domestic space that began as his master's thesis at UT Austin in 1994 and continues today. Something of an Austin staple, Andy's involvement in the art community, and community at large for that matter, is somewhat legendary. Shortly after learning of his work, I began to hear about Andy's ingenuous program, book club, which I have to say I'm very jealous that I didn't think of myself, titled Think and Drink, which is just what it sounds like and has been in full swing with the fun-loving and intellectually curious of Austin for 15 years now. While by all accounts Austin seems to be home, Andy also takes up residence in New York, where his work is represented by Lisa Cooley Gallery. His exhibition record indicates an international practice with shows from Austin and San Antonio to San Francisco, the UK, New York, Miami, Houston, Berlin, Los Angeles, and Vienna. Most recently, Andy has had work in a number of globe-spanning group exhibitions over the past year, and his solo exhibition, Bauhaus in the Middle of the Street, Bauhaus in the Middle of ... was the accumulation of his artist residency at 21ster House, get it, Bauhaus House, this past summer in Vienna, Austria. In 2012, Andy Colquitt Attainable Excellence was organized by Blaffer Museum of the University of Houston, where it showed after opening at Amoa Art House, in Austin. In conjunction with this survey exhibition, there is a full color monograph, Andy Colquitt Attainable Excellence, which was published last year by UT Press. Also in 2012, with language that is consciously unpunctuated playing a significant role, Andy had a solo show titled, okay, no, I didn't go to any museum here. I hate museums. Museums are just stores that charge you to come in. There are lots of free museums here, but they have names like Real Stores, which showed at the Devin Borden Gallery in Houston. Presumably, in fact, coinciding with his first solo museum exhibition. You can find a full list of exhibitions with beautiful images, I must say, on Andy's website or at lisacooley.com. And I'm going to stop there because the titles of his exhibition are too long and we want to get to the talk. What I appreciate about Andy and his work is a respect for and an intention to the human interactions, placemaking and what the Brooklyn Rail review of a recent show that he had in New York calls the humanity reflected in things. Issues I'm sure that will be covered or touched upon in tonight's presentation. You had to be there. Please join me in welcoming Andy Coolput.
Thanks, Terry. Thank you guys for coming. I'm going to turn it down just a little bit more. So these are what you saw when you came in, some images of my three-month vacation, residency in Vienna. This is part of, this is part of the work. Residencies are a little weird for me because this is actually the first time I've ever been invited to do a real residency. And usually, unless you're going to a specific place that has set up to do a specific process, they don't give you any tools. So here's a room, no tools, go for it. And a lot of times, since I work with found objects, I'm always worried that I'm going to be in a place that doesn't provide enough of this stuff. So a lot of shows I've had in Europe, the cities are so clean and well designed that it's really difficult to find stuff. But I was lucky on this one because there were these kind of derelict industrial spaces really close to the studio, and I was able to find quite a bit of stuff. I'm going to start with this this little video that they produced there. It's called 21. House, 21st House. That goes into a little bit of what how this came about. The curator, basically, I left the curator up, left the exhibition design up to the curator. We kind of had a bunch of discussions, and he was a willing collaborator, and so I'm going to show this and then sort of go back to 94 and come back up to this at the end. Retrieved through discussion. So when we decided to have this collaboration where the art handlers would be involved and you would interpret the work, this seemed much more exciting to me.
It's around 95 objects in the exhibition now, so I felt like I have to isolate some of them. Some of them get more openness, more space, some of them get less. Well, it was really hard to distinguish what's going to be put together with the rest and what's going to stay alone. I decided how to place the rest of the objects and how to mix them. That was also quite hard. Or how is it losing control?
It's very liberating. Very liberating. I thought it was a perfect opportunity to see if it would work. This exhibition had to be sort of comprised of the production of a 3-month period of time in a specific place. So with those limitations, yeah, super exciting.
So that soundtrack was recorded in Vienna. They call their home depot the Bauhaus Depot. So that's how the title of this show came about. And I recorded some ambient sounds in there, and that was a guy whistling. They stole that song as their advertisement, Bauhaus, in the middle of the street. So if possible, I would like to encourage people to ask questions during the talk. I do a lot better when I'm having a conversation. It's a little more casual. So feel free to just ask if you have a question. You don't have to wait till the end. going back to 1994, I was a grad student in the art department at UT, and the previous work I had done was dealing with domesticity and interior environments and the psychology of spatial arrangements, furniture arrangements, and it was a logical next step at the time, it seemed, to build a house. I was also studying with Linda Montano, who was teaching in the transmedia department, and she was a big influence on the way I thought about going about doing this project. I thought about it in this very much like a performative sense. I was interested in transforming my world from an obscure kind of installation artist to doing this thing out in the world and having conversations with city inspectors and plumbers and electricians, alongside having conversations with my graduate in the graduate seminars. So this was about 94 to 2000, 2001, which the kind of dropped out of the art world of making exhibitions, total focus on this project, which I still live in. And at the time, I don't know if I really thought this, but at the time, the dialogue around the house in the university was all about, it was very controversial, it was all about, like, can this be a work of art? Is this a work of art? A lot of people, thought it was, whatever. It was problematic. And I never really found that question that interesting. I just wanted to make something interesting. I did not care if it was art or those questions are just boring. But I think looking back on it, what really is the important shift for me was that I was creating a place. I was not doing something I guess I was expected to do in graduate school, which was to perfect a certain style, a certain process, to become an expert on making sculpture. So that lens of thinking about creating a place is something that I think about now when I create discrete objects. I see them all in this bigger picture of how it relates to coming out of the house. I've always had my studio in my domestic space. Linda Montano also aligned with another earlier influence, Alan Capro, who was interested in erasing boundaries between art and life, and that was something I was and still am very interested in. But you know, when you live it for a long time, it seems weird to even say that. Anyway, so this is that was the first building, which is an apartment, and this is the kitchen. So all this stuff developed, you know, sort of organically, finding materials in the neighborhood, deciding to put a porch there because we had some wood. And also this was a collaboration with a bunch of different people, but specifically two or three people that were living there at the time. But a collaboration with the city inspectors. One thing that was interesting was that I was collaborating with the my committee at the university, and with so that bureaucracy of the university, and then the bureaucracy of the city inspectors, and each body had two really different goals in mind, and it was quite a bit easier dealing with a city bureaucracy than.
Hey, Andy.
Yep.
The relationship between this and relational aesthetics. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not just the building you're creating place, you're also interested in what happens in those places. Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little bit about that in line with
you know, that? I had no idea, I didn't hear that term until 2002 or three. I don't know if that book was published then, or I was just not, I really was not paying attention to the art world at all. I kind of just dropped out. Someone told me, like, oh, this is kind of what you're doing, this thing called relational aesthetics. When I started, I mean, I kind of knew about Jorge Pardo, who also designed a house through an institution, MoCA, and I kind of looked at him and talked about his relationship to an institution. excuse me. When I was, you know, fighting with the institution of the art department, like, look, this is a sanction. This is a legitimate thing. But I didn't really know about his connection with that movement. But since I've learned a lot about it and really have been influenced by and look at a lot of that stuff. But yeah, it wasn't.
But I mean, knowing what you know now about that, do you see yourself having, do you see that being a part of your program in doing this, part of your interest in doing this, is creating not just a physical place, but a place for interaction?
Yes. Definitely. Yeah, it was. I wanted to create a place that would nurture my career or my life for the next however long. I had no idea that it would last this long. It was kind of like not a joke, but like, let's see if this will work. And it's crazy that it's still working. But I also wanted to create a place that was a social space, which it was. It was like this center of this group of people that were around there. Then, you know, also definitely thought about this place as an anti-institutional art space. There was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of like friction that went into creating this. But as far as that dialogue, you know, I thought about it for a while, and then, you know, I don't know. I don't really find it that comforting to adhere to where that theory came out of. You know, I've learned a lot about it from like talking to Liam Gillick about this, and you know, it was a very specific text written for a very specific reason of an exhibition in France at the time. And anyway, it's almost like a dirty word now. A lot of people hate, like, when you bring that up, it's just a negative thing. So And also that kind of like has receded a lot. I still have, there's still a lot of activities that go on there. There's this dance thing that's going to happen there next week. There was like tons of these salons, these think and drinks, and just plain old parties. But always they would turn into happenings or performances. But really it was just like the social center. It's like, it wasn't an art space where people came and showed their work. It was just a place where people came and did whatever. So that about 2002-ish, I kind of like got the itch to go back in the studio and start making objects again. And basically all the roofs, everything was dried in, and everybody that lived there kind of like, we finished the main construction project, and we all just sort of organically sort of went to the edge of the property and started doing our own things. And so I started doing these exhibitions that I sort of call as a group studio exhibitions. And this is the very last one. This is 2007. But I would basically just go into a space and for the whole run of the show, you know, set up shop there and make work, find stuff in the street, things that people gave to me. And so when I first came to the show, it was an empty room. And at the end of the month or whatever, the run of the show, it would be full. And so here there was a lot of, especially in this one, because this was 2007, I was kind of thinking a lot more about it, like what this all meant. But I think when I first started, I was kind of trying to recreate what was happening at the house in an institutional space in a very condensed amount of time. But people would come in throughout the whole run of the show, and so there's a lot of seating areas and just hanging out spaces, and so there's lots of conversations happening along with just making. And it's a very open process of making. It's just like finding stuff and reacting to it, tinkering, playing with it, moving it around. I think one thing that was interesting was that some things that I'd been kind of thinking about before I started working on the house was this subconscious ordering of the objects in a room. Like that was the important thing. Like looking at how the chairs are placed at the next morning after the party, like people's organic way of coming together, and that arrangement is telling you something that is very different from producing an installation. So not only was all this other stuff happening, making work, putting it on the wall, having conversations, it's a process thing. All that was happening, but at the same time, this, when you look at it, when I would look at it at the end of the day, it was about like what is happening with the relationship between the body and the architecture is telling me something different from if I did it consciously. Excuse me. I mean, everybody was talking about interactivity at this moment, and it's kind of, you know, receded in the dialogue. But another thing that I can't forget, there's a very practical reason to work this way, because it's really expensive to ship a whole bunch of sculpture, especially across the sea. This is in Norwich in the UK. So these shows kind of started very practically. Someone invited me to do a show in New York, and it was an artist-run space. There was no money, so I went up there and produced a project based on stuff that I found and worked in the space for 2 or 3 weeks. And that just developed over the years. I did one of these shows in a commercial gallery. This is an artist-run space. there's some early ideas of the kind of economics of retail interactivity going on here too, that come up later. But yeah, this is what it looked like. I mean, it changed every day, obviously. So I photographed it throughout the show, but this one actually is a lot more. I was at this point, like after doing this for 5 years, I was really thinking too much. I was thinking about the first idea of like that subconscious arrangement of furniture that happens. Like when you start thinking about it, it's hard for that to happen. But also another thing, this Kippenberger reference, social potato, these were potato bongs. Think and Drink started about 2 or 3 years after I got out of grad school, basically because I like missed that activity of talking about art, and I wanted a little bit more structure than just hanging out at a party and talking to someone. A little bit more, but not as much structure as a graduate seminar. So it was a bunch of my friends, and the first ones. There was artists and there's all kinds of people. It wasn't just talking about art. So we were talking about politics and healthcare and all this other stuff. But this was after. That started probably in probably about 2001, 2002.
Done.
In this specific instance, because it was an artist-run space, a lot of them went into the collections of the artists. They kind of like helped me pay for me to come over, and I wasn't working through a commercial gallery at the time, and so no one else wanted it. So I didn't really feel like I wanted to ship. Some of it got shipped back, but a lot of this stuff ended up in the collections of the artists that ran the space. Excuse me. So there's a couple of groups of images that I'm going to show before I go into the next exhibition images. And this is so I started collecting lighters at some point, and I don't know, maybe 4 years after I started this lighter collection, I started taking pictures. This was, I can't remember the year, but I've never thought of myself as a photographer or carried around a camera, and it was before digital cameras. So I never would have like taken a big camera to these spaces anyway, and I kind of felt weird about photographing them for a long time. But these things started happening, which interested me a lot, which were these, like, you know, residues of social gatherings and design decisions that were going on, seating and storage. And if you'll allow me, I'm going to just read a little excerpt from this this interview that someone asked me about these. So my initial attraction to the sites developed out of the lighter collection. At a certain point in the early days of this collection, I stumbled upon one of these sites, and I realized that the nature of this collection was not about the type of lighters, the quality, but simply about the quantity. So the fact that these spaces where people smoke crack offered many more lighters, this was the initial attraction. Before this realization, I had no particular interest in crack. As a daily activity, I usually ride my bike through the city looking at architecture, studying the character of the neighborhood. I would occasionally notice a few lighters thrown on the ground here and there. Then I started actively looking and gathering, and I usually found about 5 to 10 lighters each time I went out, just on the side of the street. And then one day I came upon a place under a tree with a concrete bench and some other broken chairs, and it looked like people had been hanging out there the night before, and I found about five or six lighters all in the same place. And I looked around, and I kept finding more and more, and then it came to something like 12 lighters that were all in the same area. This is when I realized that crack smokers go through many more lighters than cigarette smokers do. So the nature of this search changed from just riding through the streets to actively seeking out these spaces where people gather to smoke crack. I found these places everywhere around me. The spaces are outdoors, usually in the center of most American cities, usually these sort of non-spaces, undeveloped and undevelopable, that exist next to public architecture. In between spaces, especially in the South where density isn't an issue, and sometimes just overgrown, neglected residential lots. So anyway, the total amount I was bringing home after a few hours went from around 25 to 30 to around 80 to 100. I've returned to certain sites now for over 12 years, and they're still in use. At some point, I started to pay more attention to the sites. My interest was focused on the residue of a gathering of people, the design decisions of creating a living room, of creating a more comfortable place to hang out, storage solutions, and seating arrangements. The most common solution is a piece of cardboard placed on the ground or against a wall to create a primitive sofa. Often a log will be positioned for a bench, and sometimes it's simply the markings in the dirt left from people laying down, the shuffling of feet, or a small clearing of debris. Almost always there's this recognition of some form of ceiling structure, be it a tree canopy, an architectural overhang, or a simple pipe leaning against the wall suggesting a roof line. So it was this suggestion, like a prototype of a seating arrangement, the suggestion of a social engagement. And the lighters are always just left there, casually placed in these living rooms, adding touches of color. I read this as well as an attempt at domestication, the idea of creating comfort through collection and object fetishization. So these, I would just see these things and I would just think, sectional, sofa, sofa, storage. This one is an amazing storage solution. Cold storage, food storage. So let's see, about 2007-ish, I started, I was working in that same, this is the same time frame as the studio exhibitions, but I started making these works, which I kind of refer to generally as pipe lights, these works made out of found pipes, tubes, and usually have light bulbs. And I got basically Lisa Cooley, my gallerist, kind of looked at the whole body of work and said, I'm not really interested in that big mess that you make. I just kind of like these things. So I had my first show in a real commercial gallery kind of ever in 2008. So this was the first solo show. I did a two-person show with her at the beginning of 2008, January. This was October. And this is kind of like as minimal of a group, a spatial arrangement as I get. I kind of like think about my trajectory of maximalism to this, and as sort of like starting out up until that's 2008. So starting out up in here, including the house and those studio exhibitions, and then it gets like really, really focused, and then it's kind of been opening back up since then. But I always just sort of saw this as a form of theater, kind of not necessarily that interesting form of theater, i.e. like the White Cube with very minimal interaction with the architecture, which I'll kind of go into a little bit later. But also at this point, I'd already kind of like freaked out and recognize that, you know, you like go along and you're doing your thing and this one thing gets picked out and it happens to be in New York and like people first like understand who you are on that one thing. So you're like, no, like I do all these things. Like, so I was really like wanting to fill back in all these other processes and ideas. And it's kind of been, that's kind of been what's happening since this point. And, you know, in a commercial gallery situation where there's just like a whole different group of pressures. And but also one thing that kind of happened in this installation was this, like, this little thing, this little act of putting these two objects just so, where it was still obvious that they read as discrete objects, but there was just this possibility of it being a tableau. This is the very beginnings of this idea that I develop a lot more later. What is it about like that thing that makes the thing on the right act differently and read differently because the thing on the left is interacting with it? So I've kind of been talking about this example of I don't know, like the socioeconomics of spatial arrangement, of density and openness. And I've used these three retail spaces as examples of different forms of density and openness and three different economies. So the Comme des Garçons example being basically patterned after a traditional white cube gallery. The placement of, very minimal placement of objects. You're not putting all your product out. Sometimes there's just like one pair of shoes against a big, vast wall. And what does it mean to have like this like amount of openness? What are the economics of that? What does it say about I don't know, the luxury of it and the recognition of the interaction of the retail store fixture and the museum vitrine? But just vast areas of emptiness, because you can, I guess. And then the sort of middle ground, the Urban Outfitters example, is based more on a domestic sort of organic arrangement of objects, specifically kind of like the urban creative type. But the level of density is what I'm thinking about here. This is sort of more, it's sort of a middle ground between these two examples. Also, they're really interested in this idea of the way the artist lives in Soho, I guess. Someone's idea of that. So the northern light coming in, the level changes and the exposed structural elements, and even a little, look, we know who Gordon Monta Clark is kind of thing. And then in the Salvation Army, which is just basically packing as much product as it can into the space, and it's about exactly that. It's like the most efficient use of the amount of space that you have. And so what is that level of density? How, as an artist, are we thinking about, like, when you're creating an exhibition, what do you want to talk about, like, when you have these like extreme vast open areas and these like super dense areas? So I've been talking about this idea that's been rolling around my head for a while, and this is the first time I've ever like grabbed images to kind of illustrate it. But I mean, it's hard for me not to like look at something like this and think of Christoph Buchel or Jason Rhodes or it's hard not to think of everything that I see in the world in terms of how it comes together in this art dialogue. So this is about 2010, and this is a show in Milan at a gallery called Zero, and about half of this stuff was shipped from my gallery and half I brought from my studio in Austin and created this environment, this room on site. And this, I kind of think a lot about this arrangement of objects as being a sort of comfortable default position of where I sort of land at different points. There's, you know, it's definitely a white cube. It's, this building has a lot of texture. It's not like super sterile, but there's the amount of openness, the amount of space between the objects, I think of through terms of generosity to the viewer and manipulation of the viewer when there's like this thing that I'm trying to push the body through a dense arrangement. It's, I think of it in terms of manipulating the body in the same way that it happens in retail traffic flow situations. But so this other thing, going back to that idea of the tableau, this is an example of, you have this one discrete object that was made, you know, somewhere around 2008, and it existed and it was shown as a discrete object for, I think, two different exhibitions. And then it comes here, and I'd started to think about this freedom of allowing the work that comes out of the studio to exist in a similar vibe that existed in the studio. Obviously, it's going to be different because there's always that, what Daniel Buran calls the unspeakable compromise of the portable work of art. You always, something happens when it comes from the studio and goes into a public exhibition space. But it, so these things I think of as, all these objects I think of as sort of supporting characters for the finished sculpture. And then something happens and it becomes, that becomes the sculpture now. So it, the easiest way to explain it is this object was, it has a catalog number as a thing in my inventory. And after this show, the catalog number changes and the thing is the group, the tableau. So when this is shown again, which you'll see in the survey show, it's shown as that grouping. Whereas something like this, which I think of as an equally interesting and successful tableau of objects, just that didn't happen. These things came down, they got dispersed, they get put into other things, and I don't really know what that means, but that's just...
So there's no particular criteria for what it's saying is a distinct object or a tableau. It's just, if conditions are such that it ends up going on to become that again, and it starts over time, because it's repeated, it becomes a thing. Is that the way it works?
Say that again.
But if so there's no particular criteria. You're not going into this with a particular criteria for what makes it out of that exhibition as a tableau,
right,
or as a single thing together. It's just, if it does, it does. Like, there's no particular criteria for that.
I guess there's not. I mean, there must be somewhere because there's a decision has been made. But why the one before and not this one, not that one, and that one, yes, same thing happens. So this tableau was shown again in the survey show, and it was all these objects are now a part of that piece. The discreteness is no longer like that discrete object, which is the light bulb thing. Now has this group that travels with it.
But when you showed that, Andy, did you think about like that great radiator and that electric pipe that comes down the wall and that all of that sort of framing it in that particular condition? Like, was that part of your decision?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's this, like, problematic relationship with the idea of site specificity.
Yeah.
Because it's so obvious that you, that an artist that thinks about these things has to respond to the building. But really, like, the specificity of this white cube in Milan versus the specificity of a similar white cube in New York is not that much different. The way that we, the way that this work traffics now, it's just not that interesting for me to think about it that way. But yes, obviously, I respond to the texture of this amazing space. This being a great example, this is just the only thing I did was put this little arm there. These holes were drilled in. It was a shelving unit or something. And I like to do this. This is a piece which is a homage to an artist who's been a big influence on me, Franz West. And so this piece is called When It's Down, Put It Up, and When It's Up, Put It Down. So, this was, I guess, a little bit later in 2010 as well. And so somebody asked me to do, a curator at the, what was Art House then, now the Contemporary in Austin, asked me to do an installation in the foyer of the building. And it used to be a retail space. It's a storefront on the corner. So I was thinking about, this is my studio, I was thinking about this wall and that wall as these two glass walls that open up onto the street. And so it's a, you know, it's the foyer of the building, so it's a heavy traffic area as the entrance. And so the kind of first thing that I was thinking about might be interesting, since I lean a lot of things against the wall, was just being able to walk around to the other side of the piece of glass and see the work from an angle that you can't see it usually. So I kind of had all these objects in my head and in the room, basically placed kind of in that, what I refer to as that default position of what you just saw in Milan. They were spaced out. There was these little suggestions of tableaus happening between two objects. And there's actually a column in the foyer of the Contemporary that's in a similar location. But for one reason, for some reason, it just wasn't, it wasn't working. There was too much traffic flow. I don't know why, but it just wasn't working. And out of frustration one day, I just kind of shoved everything in the corner. And later I came back and put this piece of carpet down, but it was kind of, it was very similar to this, maybe a little junkier, but it was this kind of like question of this relationship between a discrete object and its environment that I had been kind of like concerned with for the last couple of years. It was like, duh, this is not an environment anymore. You cannot like walk in it. It's just a sculpture. Even though it's a group of stuff, group of things, it's very much its own discrete sculpture, this grouping. It's kind of like obvious. But I kind of immediately thought these two, what I was thinking about, these two glass walls that were in the space of the Contemporary, I thought, well, it doesn't have to be site-specific anymore. I can create these two glass walls and bring this thing out to the center of the room, and I can create them on a plex and make this kind of half-vitrine thing. And even to accentuate the fact that it's a sculpture now, I could raise this pedestal, which I could raise it off the ground a little plinth, and it could read more as a pedestal. So I'm going to go a little bit out of order chronologically right now, but it makes sense. I didn't get to do this piece. This is the title that Terry read earlier. I didn't get to do this piece for a couple of years after that. But this other thing happened, which I'll go into after this. So this is it, a couple of years later in Devin Borden Gallery in Houston. So the relationship between each one of these objects in the total environment is complicated by this kind of super density. The body cannot enter. The other thing going on was this, the way this is oriented in this space. I kind of wanted the viewer to look at it in this direction, the first thing that you saw, because I wanted those two glass walls to be in the same place that this idea first happened. And the reason why I didn't want it to be oriented like this at the beginning was that I didn't want that... it's hard to articulate. That little thing that happens, like immediately when you see something in the first like millisecond, I didn't want someone to read this as a four-sided vitrine and then that information to flow after, you know, a little bit, and to, that little like trick to happen. I was kind of curious. I didn't trust that little trick, but it just did not work in the space for some reason the way I wanted to orient it, and so that's how it happened. I don't know if it's even a thing that people thought about, but so what did happen in between the thing in the studio and this piece was this piece. So this is called Plus Sign, and it was kind of just a logical extension of that idea of the two sides of the vitrine, but in this instance it would be four sides of the vitrine, and just sort of instead of an enclosed box, the walls would sort of collapse and make a shape like a plus sign or an X. And I kind of have no idea if I can prove this or whatever, but I really thought like this is going to be a discrete object and an environment at the same time. Like it's a sculpture. It's not site specific. The only thing that's specific about it is it's on the floor, but it could be sitting anywhere. It doesn't rely on the architecture in that way. And you see it all at once. So you see the object, you see the sculpture. But because of the size of these walls, which are about 8 feet tall and 12 feet long, each one of these rooms is the size of a room. So when you're walking into these spaces, and I was very... interested in pushing people into these spaces, that it's just a fact that you're in an environment and you're experiencing these objects in this room in the same way that you experience real architecture.
Did that work? Did people actually enter, or did they stay on the periphery?
No, people did, yeah. There's a lot of like easy tricks to get people in, making tiny things further in, so you want to... You're curious enough to walk into them. Also, the thing that when I started thinking about these populating these four different quadrants of this sculpture, I wanted each one to have its own vibe. And so the easiest way for me to think about that was to... You know, a few things started happening, but then I kind of felt like I had to name them, and that would help me like populate each quadrant and give it its own vibe. So this one was named Light. This one to the left was named Heavy. this one fluorescent, and we're going around clockwise. And this one, the first thing I thought was poor, and then that later kind of developed into potato, but kind of means the same thing. And these were just like things that could, like I say, would help me like populate the spaces with the right objects. Also, the other thing that was going on was these big pieces of plex were being held up. They were both holding up these leaning sticks, and they were being held up by these diagonal supports. And there was only this one object that actually pierced through the two sides, and it was this Four Loko drying rack thing. And so this is what you would see if you write in the so that's potato, fluorescent, heavy, and light. And yeah, so I was really interested in like what happens with, I mean, this is about all the work, what happens with the relationship between the object and the body and the object and the body and the other viewer. And so you're standing in this space and you have this physical real relationship with these things. You see the objects in the other three spaces behind glass, behind the vitrine. So they're protected, and there's this level of dustiness or dirt that is important that glass protects you from and does what vitrines always do in museums, which is problematic. It's always like taking that, it's that thing that I was saying about the compromise. It's always taking that thing and doing something else with it, elevating it, taking it out of the functional aspect of what it's doing for you, the artist, and its performative aspects, and elevating it and protecting it, and what happens there, you know.
So the vitrine thing is intentionally trying to create a kind of frustration for the viewer, like you can see it, you can't get to it.
Yeah.
But in your case, if you walk around, you can't get to it.
Right. So you see, you experience the objects in this quadrant, this light quadrant, as you experience things in every day in rooms. And only the other things are only behind glass, so you experience them only in this visual way. But obviously, when you walk around to the other quadrant, and you're doing that now with this group of objects, and you have not only this visual understanding of these objects, but you have the memory of that you were just in that side. So yeah, it is trying to be. It is. I think I can prove that it is a discrete object and an environment at the same time. The kind of like bang you over the head, obvious metaphor of the dust on the pedestal. So the pants, as you see in plus sign, get taken into the next exhibition. Chair. This exhibition was called Chair with Paintings. This was so plus sign was in Miami, Locus Projects, 2011. This is 2012 in Lisa Cooley Gallery. And so this one I can't quite be so bold as to say that this worked, but it was like it was an experiment, and I don't care if it doesn't work. It's like this is the idea that leads me to think about how to organize these spaces. So I was thinking about that, what happens with all the objects within plus sign. You have this, they're all like within the same thing, so they don't have their discreteness anymore. They don't have the same responsibility and separateness, so you read them indifferently. Can I extend that platform of the plus sign of the vitrine into, can I lose that and just use the platform of the gallery, in this case, a storefront, as most galleries are in New York, former retail spaces, as that same element, that same platform that, so the things are pushed apart. They're not, this is not one sculpture. This is obviously a group of discrete objects. But there is this thing that's happening in the center that's kind of acting the same way the vitrine was in plus sign, but in a different way. It's this counter. So I'm going to read, I'm doing an interview with this guy that just about this one piece within this whole show. We're just talking about this one object, and I can articulate it a lot better in writing. So he's, there's a few questions that lead up to it, but he's asking about how much time, I don't know why this is a question, but how much time did you spend physically making this piece? And then how much time do you spend thinking about it? I mean, I think he was making the point that the work is pretty jankily produced and possibly overthought. But so the question is, how much time do you spend thinking about it? And I said, that's a tough question. The short answer is a lot more. The long answer is all of the time from when the previous work plus sign becomes a real thing in the world, and then trying to understand what it's doing, if it works or not, and how it relates to previous ideas of the object-environment relationship. And then it opens up new questions. And with this knowledge, this freedom to build upon the new position, I think about how I might be able to extend that position within a different room and let the discrete objects roam a bit. The main difference in the two works is that plus sign is a clear architectural platform that engulfs these smaller objects, and counter, this piece is called counter, is a separate place in itself that I thought of as the best place in the room to view the other objects. In other words, with plus sign, the viewer walked into the work, and with counter, they either simply stand next to it or lean on it. It's less manipulative. It allows the viewer more freedom. So the initial idea takes months. Then you get the thing built, and it's sitting in the studio, and you walk by it every day, and people come over, and you watch what they do with it, if they lean on it or put their bag on it. And that takes another couple of months. And then there's a lot of time thinking about how the vitrine would contain the wooden form. My initial idea was to use the same thickness of plex, 3/4 inch, and build a somewhat traditional vitrine to house the form. The idea was that the vitrine would only be slightly larger than the wooden form, with maybe 1/8 inch between the wood and the plex. Like this object grew and grew until it filled up the entire vitrine. Then this idea was rejected because it seemed too overproduced and too clean. A few days later, the idea to clad the wood in much thinner sheets came, and the plex would be attached directly to the wood. It would be attached with these little panhead screws, which would add this other dimension. And this decision with the screws really locked in this idea of the wooden form, which had up until that point in my head existed as a maybe sculpture or a maybe pedestal, into a counter. The cladding made it lowfalutin and put it into that sphere of a transaction object, like the counter you might see at an old hardware store or possibly an outdoor flea market. So one of the most important things that happens with counter relates to how the smaller objects have this freedom to roam. In the earlier work, where the objects are physically dependent upon the on the platform, they didn't have to carry that much information. They could be half-assed. When they exist on their own, then we have to regard them as discrete objects. They get bumped up from being minor supporting characters into this larger role. They have more responsibility as individuals. So the interesting thing for me was to see just exactly how pedestrian something could be yet still demand our attention. Like that little Four Loko drying rack can. And this piece. This piece, the Four Loko drying can. So there are, like, obviously these other works in this room that are clearly existing as sort of metaphors of that whole thing, like this piece. This is a second kind of iteration of this piece that was similar. The first one was called This Is Not a Vitrine. This one is called This Vitrine Don't Work. This is the back room. So this is This is a show that was put together by the Blaffer Museum in Houston, and it had its first run in Austin. This is at the Contemporary. There's about 10 images of it in the Contemporary, and then a few in Houston. It's the same show. It's a survey show. So a lot of these objects had been, you know, in, I hadn't seen them in a long time. But I was kind of like at the right in the middle of thinking about these ideas of density and openness and relationship between discrete object and total environment. So this room was kind of the first decision to be made was what to do with this wall. This is a movable wall. There's these pulleys that run along these I-beams. It's difficult to think about a movable wall and for a number of reasons, but basically they made it because they left one side of the museum unfinished, which is impossible to show work on. So the idea, I guess, that most people do is push this big wall up against the left and have just one big open cavernous space. Which I thought about. We put it over there and looked at it, and it didn't really hide the wall. It just looked like we were trying to hide the wall. So the other idea would be to put it in the middle, which would be stupid because it wouldn't work for a cohesive show. And so this is kind of what I decided to do was to make this alley and put all these sticks against one wall and kind of just push the viewer into this a lot more intimate relationship with the objects than they possibly would have chosen to do on their own. And then, even though I didn't really need it, I felt like this yellow line, which I kind of thought of as a wainscoting, a super graphic of a wainscoting, I stole from this Egyptian room in this museum in Berlin, would just tie all these objects together as a tableau. So the dimension between the object that sticks out the furthest from the wall and this wall is exactly the ADA dimension, 36 inches allowed. So it's not like super tight, but it's definitely something people know that something has been that they're being pushed into an alley, I guess. And you know, the term of what it was kind of like thought about like a corridor. Now, corridor sounds stupid. Like, you know, alley was what worked. It was an alley. It's sort of something that has this kind of possibly illicit overtone. These things, a lot of times people refer to these things as junkies, these skinny, pathetic constructions. So when you open back up into the larger space, again, I think that default position of these relationships that I think allow a certain amount of generosity to the viewer to feel like there's something going on between relationships, between objects. You're not just walking, looking at objects like this, slipping over like this, but there's not the same type of manipulation of shoving you down an alley. And I mean, these, you know, pretty vast areas of openness really like allow you to have this kind of very formal, and also with the photography, I realized like this stuff needs to have this super formal framing. Both of these. So this is the same show in Houston. So obviously the first thing you have to decide is what to do with this gallery and this like totally schizo space. Like this is about 25 feet tall, huge ceilinged room, and it's a square, maybe 40 feet by 40 by 40, and it also has this like major traffic flow going from the entrance to this to the gallery into the second gallery. So the idea of like putting sticks against this wall just seemed like wrong. So kind of, and a lot of these sticks are too tall for the ceiling in this room. So basically the only decision was to populate these works in a sort of U shape around these walls or to do this, which I kind of like was really interested in like complicating the viewership of the discrete object. And not only that, but of objects that had existed in collections. Like if you remember the last installation in Austin, this piece, which consists of the striped bench and this hanging pendant and these two sticks, is in a collection. I felt like it was necessary to talk to the collector and sort of get his permission that I could violate the work in this way, by putting these two sticks on top of the bench and hanging this in front of it so that people that came to this exhibition saw this tableau in a in a way that was complicated from the way it exists in his collection. And that happened in a number of other areas through here. And that piece that was in Chair with Paintings, this vitrine don't work, is totally disassembled here. There's just one stick that barely touches into the vitrine. Everything else is scattered. So the scale is a little deceptive in these. This piece is like 12 feet tall. This room is huge. It's really hard for, I've seen two shows in here now. It's just a really difficult room. It's a tough room. But, you know, the really, like, obviously what I was interested in doing was creating this huge, vast area of openness and this super dense arrangement of objects to create these two kinds of zones. So this is inside all that stuff looking back. That's the to the left is the entrance to the museum, and to the right to the smaller gallery. And so this, the wainscoting stripe here, instead of like tying all these objects together as a tableau, it actually brings the viewer in between the stripe and the objects. So what to do in this, when I was installing this, the curator kind of just asked me, this is the second time an artist had installed in this space, two separate solo shows, and she asked, do you think it would work to have, you know, two artists, to have an artist in this small room and an artist in the big room? And I was like, I think that's the only way it would work. This is really, really hard to have a cohesive, it's impossible to have a cohesive exhibition. It's such a totally different room. And here, again, goes back to that kind of position, default position of comfortable arrangement of objects, generosity, not like pretty vast areas of openness, but nothing like the other room. So that's an example of how that tableau travels from one exhibition to the next. Another thing I was thinking about is I didn't want this openness to seem like that thing that happens at Comme des Garçons, that sterility and that luxury of we can utilize the nothingness of all this real estate because we can. I was more interested in this emptiness being more like neglected emptiness, like someone cleaned up and got all the stuff and got out in the middle of the night, and it's dirty but empty. So these specifically this piece like is so incredibly different from the way it existed in Milan with that super rich building with the radiator. It's so quiet and it's just so different. It's the same objects, but another thing that happened just because it seemed like I had to recognize this was the lighting scheme in the two rooms were quite different. This was a very like blue cold room, and this the photography changes it a bit. It's a lot more yellow in reality, but this lower room was more incandescent. Okay, so now we're back here. Yep. So this is the last group. So I was thinking about all this stuff when I got invited to this residency and talking with this curator, Severin Duntzer, quite a bit about these ideas of density and openness. And he kind of looked at that exhibition in Houston, and one thing that I felt like was not super successful was that people didn't really recognize that large area of openness was something that was happening to their body. It was just kind of like they saw the group of works against the wall as a landscape and read them as that thing that I didn't like the way people read the thing, which is just standing there and not activating the body. So he was like, oh, no, you put this, you do that on the opposite. You put the stuff at the front of the room, and then when you walk in, you have the openness. So I was like, ah, you're exactly right. Why don't you do this? So we had many, many conversations, but we both agreed that, in a collaboration, that he would arrange the works based upon things that we were talking about. So this arrangement is all his doing. So that another thing that I didn't really think would or didn't know that would happen was not only do you have this like immediate recognition of this like cluster super density of objects, when you walk in, all that stuff's behind you, so you feel a little bit like weird when the stuff is behind you. You know it's there the whole time you're in the room. So this is walking in and then turning to the left, and it, the openness happens after that. So he's really interested in like putting a lot of these sticks upside down. Like this stick existed in my studio for a month or so, you know. Turned the other way around. And I walked in. So the agreement between us was that we get the art handlers to take the stuff to the room. He installs the show, and I come in and I have to live with it. There were a few things that needed to be hung that he didn't know exactly how to hang, but I didn't move anything around. So that was...
Were you happy?
You know, like, I people always ask that, and I think I was too happy. I think, like, I would have been happier if he would have done something, like, totally, like... That would have taught me something, you know, like, it would have been, like, more jarring that I would have still been thinking about. It was kind of like I think he had an idea to do that, and he worked on it for a long time, and that's where he came back to those conversations. That I think it really worked. So, yes, I was happy that it worked, but I kind of also wish it would have been more jarring. When I walked in, it was more like, oh, yeah, yes, yes, obviously, yes. The other thing that was happening was we made this agreement, and then he didn't come to my studio for about 3 weeks before doing the installation, and I said, I'm going to, like, complicate your life a little bit more and make this vitrine that... you can either like use these objects to populate this vitrine or leave it alone or whatever. So that was another thing that just to mess with him pretty much. So this vitrine in my studio over those past 3 weeks was like way, way denser. Way populated with like a lot more stuff, and we took this same about half of these objects to a fair in Berlin and installed it in the way that I had it in the studio. But he kind of, I don't know if he like hated the piece or didn't know like what could go with it or what, but he didn't really do a whole lot with it. It's kind of like an empty, like that thing that neglected, like all the stuff's taken off of it in the middle of the night and it's just sort of there. But this arrangement of objects, I thought, you know, I guess that is the one thing that is really, it feels good to see someone like take an idea and like push it further and go. Like I was just really interested in like this idea of translation, like language translation and being dislocated in a different culture and that insecurity that comes with dislocation. And so you're like hyper aware of all this stuff and seeing if like how it would be filtered through a curator. And I just like thought this idea of collaboration with this person at this instance makes perfect sense because, you know, I think the idea of like having an exhibition at the end of a residency is a bit problematic in that you're kind of producing a show instead of possibly experimenting with ideas. So I kind of like took the pressure of that, like 3 months, you got to produce a show with all the stuff you find here and just sort of let it go and said, well, you know, that's true, but also like the show has to be of all the stuff that I make in 3 months. So if I don't make anything interesting, guess what? That's the show you get. But that, you know, translation of this kind of level of density and then pushing it even further. That was probably like the most satisfying part of that. That's it.